If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Ross Kemp. Over the last 18 years, I've made some 90-odd documentaries, predominantly in hostile environments, from Afghanistan to Syria, from El Salvador to the Congo. And it's fair to say that during that time, I found myself in a few interesting situations. I've been shot at, tear gassed, had knives pulled on me, and spears thrown at me. But in all those years, what's impressed me the most is the resilience of the human spirit. Our ability, no matter where we're from, to overcome and make it through to the other side. So, in my new series, The Kemp Cast, I'll be talking to some incredible individuals who all have engaging stories to tell and have themselves overcome some extremely tough moments in their lives. Right now, we're living in unprecedented times, and we should be doing all we can together to get through this as safely as possible. I hope that if you subscribe to the Kempcast and hear how my guests overcame their toughest moments, it may help you overcome yours, whether you're going through one right now or you're faced with one in the future. Joining me today is BAFTA-winning explorer, author, and television presenter, Steve Backshall, MBE. Best known for his TV shows Deadly 60 and Expedition. I hope you enjoy the show. Steve, thank you so much for agreeing to talk to me. How are you, mate?
I'm doing surprisingly well.
Yeah? How are you finding lockdown?
Do you know what? Lockdown's been a rare opportunity for me. I think that I spend so much of my time away and an awful lot of time missing home. And to be forced to be at home, for whatever reason, it is quite a rare thing. To be forced to be at home when I have two babes in arms that are only a few months old and a youngster who's, you know, just two, has been an opportunity to be a proper dad for a change.
Yeah. So how often are you away in a year? How long does Helen say goodbye for?
So I would say that the average is somewhere between 5 and 8 months, although I have been away for longer than that before. But what really is the killer are the trips where you are properly away, where you're away and you're in, you know, the wildest places you can imagine, where your communication with back home is, you know, few and far between. Those are the ones that never used to bother me when I was in my 20s, but now they're starting to get a little bit old.
What you mean when you get that sat phone connection that lasts for about half a second? Once you've got through, you've been wandering around. Go on, give us some examples, some of the places where you've got your sat phone eventually to work, and as soon as you've got through, it's got clunk, clunk.
It's rainforest. Rainforests are the worst because you've got canopy, and so you know you might just be able to find a little place where you can see the sky, and like you absolutely hit the nail on the head. You know, you get a connection just long enough to say, "Hello, are you there? Can you hear me? Are you? It's me. It's gone," and that's it. And that might be it for the rest of the day, and that can be really, really tough. Particularly now that, you know, we're in a modern world where people are used to be able to not just able to speak to each other on the phone, but being able to have video calls at the blink of an eye. And all of a sudden you can be somewhere where that is completely gone and you're cast back 100 years to basically tapping out, you know, Morse code to try and get a message back home.
And also because you build up your expectations that you are going to get through and that you are going to get someone that is different from that small niche team that you're with. Particularly if you're in an extreme situation where you find yourself very often.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And that has become much more important since becoming a dad. You know, I've only been a dad for 2 years, and I've spent an awful lot of that time in places that are hell and gone from anywhere. And, you know, when your kids are really young, they change by the minute, they change by the hour. You go away on a 6-week trip and you come back and they are unrecognizable, and you've missed all these little landmarks in their life. You've missed them having their first smile or laugh or crawl. And that stuff, that massive cliche, but you will never, ever get back.
Mm. I was reading some of the things that you've said about being in lockdown and how fantastic it's been, particularly because you live on the Thames, you've been doing your swimming, you've noticed. I've noticed I had a pair of foxes in my garden fighting over my golden retriever's toy the other day. Now, and I went out there and normally they would have scuttled and they just looked at me and said, "It's our toy, go away."
It's amazing, isn't it? I think that an awful lot of people have reconnected with nature through this period of time, through lockdown. And I think that particularly at the beginning of lockdown, when we had that one precious hour a day when we were allowed to go out and, you know, do some exercise, allowed to go out and go for a walk in the woods, that people started to focus on it more and started to appreciate every single second of it. And all of a sudden, I was getting contact from people going, "This is a bird calling in my garden that I've never heard before. What is it? I've just seen this bug in my cabbage patch that I've never seen before." And I think there's definitely a point where we have all switched on to nature in a way that has been different to ever before. But also the lack of us, the fact that, you know, we have been outdoors so much less, that our vehicles have been less motive, that our certainly here on the river, we've had less boat traffic, made a massive difference so quickly, and nature bounced back in a big way. And like you say, there's wild animals that've got a look in their eye like, "Hang on a sec, this is my patch, what are you doing here?"
And it was kind of sort of immediate. Within 2 weeks of lockdown, it was very different. I was fortunate because I was moving around a bit during lockdown. There was just no traffic, and it was like they sensed it immediately and said, "Do you know what, this is what it should be like."
Yeah, do you know what? We did an amazing story down in Dorset in Studland Bay, where they have a lot of issues between boat traffic and the seagrass meadows that grow there in this beautiful, beautiful bay and the animals that live there. And over the course of lockdown, there was no boat traffic, so the seagrass meadows came back, and all of a sudden they were filled with seahorses. And no one's seen seahorses there for years. And all of a sudden they were everywhere. And it's kind of like this instantaneous bounce back effect that nature regenerates so quickly in the absence of us.
Do you think we are rapidly destroying our planet then?
You know what, it's so difficult, isn't it? Because I, in so many places, have seen the effects over time of human beings in a way that is frustrating and sometimes crushing. But I have also seen the flip side of that, and I've seen places that have bounced back. So, for example, we did an amazing series in Monterey Bay in California. What was that? Probably about 10 years ago now. And seeing this place, which had been effectively completely dead, had been wiped out by fishing and too much boat traffic. And then it was made into a marine reserve. And within the course of a decade, they had blue whales and humpback whales and sperm whales popping up back in this place that is abundant with life. And it does convince me that nature is robust in certain situations. And I think that that's really, really important, because as a conservationist, it would be so easy to be pessimistic and to be negative. But having seen, give nature a chance and it will bounce back, that's a real reason to get involved in conservation, isn't it? And it's a real reason to sell to people, you know, if you create marine reserves off the coast of the UK, then we'll have blue whales and sperm whales and humpback whales. No reason why we shouldn't have. If you take some of the portions of our, you know, massively industrialized and over agriculture driven landscape here in the UK and make them wild again, then they will just burst into life in a matter of years. And that's important. People need to know that.
You've joined the Green Party, is that right?
I have. It was... Do you know, that was a bold thing for me. I don't talk about my politics a tremendous amount, but I have been, I'm a bit of a lefty. I'm kind of someone that believes.
You're talking about it now. Go on, man.
I know, I really am. So I've kind of, I totally reacted against my parents' politics. I have been a Labour voter ever since I've been allowed. But then in the last few years, I've become somewhat disaffected with that. And I've become more aware that, you know, I think the Green Party has an ethos about it and a way of working that may be idealistic, and maybe a lot of their ideas may not work. And yes, they are struggling to get any more than one single MP, but they're good people who have a positive idea for how they want to make the planet better. And I am quite proud to be a part of that. I think that, you know, there is no way that we are going to take control of this country, but by providing some of our ideas and some of our maxims for a better future, then maybe we can provide influence. And I think that, you know, I would like people to know that voting for someone in the Green Party as your local politician, getting a chance of having one more MP, two more MPs, could make a really big difference to how we run this country positively.
Let's go back to the beginning, and let's go back to Steve leaving uni. First of all, though, theatre studies?
Oh, God, don't.
Come on.
Do not get me started.
Get me on the theatre studies. Come on.
Do you know what? It's quite a long story. How much time have you got?
As long as you want, mate.
Okay, so I think if I look back at my childhood, wow, this is something I really genuinely haven't talked about before, but I think I had a very, very happy family life and a miserable school life. And I was very much searching to try and find who I was and what my you know, future was going to be. I went to a very average, that's putting it politely, comprehensive school where the teaching was appalling, and I just lost all my love for learning.
Sounds like my life so far. I love my family. Went to an average comprehensive. God bless it. It's a lot better now in Essex. Never fitted in at school and was always looking for something else.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's just exactly the same. And I was a bright kid, naturally quite bright. So I could kind of, you know, cruise through my classes without having to do any work. I pretty much failed my GCSEs, but then I got onto my A-levels and I met the teacher that everyone, you know, kind of always talks about as the one person who switched all my buttons, got me back interested in learning, got me fascinated by ideas and by philosophy and by politics. And it just so happened that he taught theatre. And because of Rob Brown, this one person who has been, you know, such a critical presence in my life, that's what I went to university and did. And the second I got to university, I looked around and went, I don't really like theatre very much, but you know, I think it was so important in my life because it was the time when I switched back to, you know, not wanting to be one of the cool kids and just basically arse about all the time, but actually try and do and achieve something. And then, you know, I went back to university and I studied biology and got back into, I guess, the more natural me. But if it hadn't been for that one teacher just inspiring me and kind of setting me off on the right path, then God knows where I'd be now.
You are an incredibly positive individual. Do you know the people you said took the mickey, they said best ever back then when you were always the best ever. But do you not think that is intrinsic to being able to do what you do? You know, whether it's climbing a waterfall that's frozen that no one else has done, or going into a cave that is unexplored.
It's certainly my defining characteristic. And I think that anyone who knew me for, you know, a short period of time might think that it was to an extent put on or created, because I do have a tendency to look at every single idea, every single project, every single moment of the day and think, like you say, this is the best ever. And I think that enthusiasm has driven my friends and family mad for years, but it is my defining characteristic and always has been. I think that it's driven a huge amount of what I've done in my life has been that incessant kind of, yeah, let's do it. Someone says, oh, do you know what? I've always wanted to walk the Pennine Way. And my response will be, well, let's go this weekend. And you know, that is, I think, the part of my character that's just kept on pushing and pushing and pushing. And I think I'm very, very lucky in that I know how to reset my own positivity. If I find myself kind of lagging or feeling low, I know that what I need to do is to get outside and do some exercise and, you know, go out looking for animals. And the second I do that, I'm back on cloud nine again. And I'm very, very lucky to have that. And I think the positivity too.
We were talking to a guy called Ross Edgley, you know, he swam around the channel amongst many other things.
What a hero.
But again, Steve, he talks about that positivity, about you can draw that up inside you. And it's clinically proven that people who have positive energy do better at most things, whether it's making money or whether it's lifting weights or martial arts. Again, you know, you have faced some extreme situations where you can't get on the phone and go, come and get me. Do you think that positivity again has seen you through those dark moments?
I think, how can I put this? I think Ross is an awful lot better at elucidating this than I am. He's probably sat down and thought about it an awful lot more than I have. And I probably should do too, because then I could write a best-selling book like his. Which
Well, you have. You're right. You've written a brilliant book. So
I think what you're kind of getting at is what everyone's searching for, isn't it really? It's finding a way of being able to format and bottle that positivity and find a way of being able, to be able to use it as a resource, because it gets you out of so many scrapes, that being up and being positive. I'm sure that many of the encounters that you've had with people, being able to have a positive response to them rather than an aggressive response or a negative response, is everything. And it's exactly the same working with animals. It's exactly the same working with a team on expedition. And yeah, I probably should spend more time thinking about how it works and trying to break it down to its nuts and bolts, because I think it is incredibly important.
And I think that animals can pick up on that just as much as human beings.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of the cliches about working with animals are completely true. The number one of which is that animals can smell fear. I mean, it's not always smelling, but they can definitely sense fear in a human being and in other animals as well. And whenever you're working with particularly predators, the number one rule is you don't run, you don't show fear, you show confidence. If you're, for example, diving with sharks or diving with crocodiles, you do everything you can to bring down your heart rate, to bring down your breathing, because the second you start to get stressed, your heart rate goes up. You're sending little vibrations out into the water that animals can sense, and you're exuding pheromones that animals can pick up on, and they react negatively to them. And that's everything from wasps in your back garden to dogs to horses. Anybody that works with animals knows this. You step up a limit when you're working with tigers and great white sharks, but it is exactly the same. Your attitude and the way that you deal with them is essential to the outcome you're going to get.
Yeah, and just those tips again, next time I find myself swimming with a Nile crocodile, is just to kind of keep my heart rate down.
It is to I know it's absolutely crazy, but so the step up with that is that crocodiles have around their what would be lips if they had lips, but around the scales that lie in their jaws, they have packed nerve endings which end up in this little bump just around the jaws, and those are absolutely triggered at vibration. So a bird falls into the water and is struggling. They sense it. They go for it. Something comes down to the water's edge and drinks. It creates a little ripple. They target it. So I have dived alongside 4.5 meter long Nile crocodiles. And you've just, every single second, you're saying, just keep calm. Keep calm. Keep your breathing down. Keep your heart rate down. And that's the only thing that is absolutely critical.
Were you wearing a tank? Or were you snorkeling? How were you doing it?
So we've done both, but definitely the most frightening was diving. So the Okavango Delta in Botswana, somewhere I'm sure you've been yourself.
I've never been to Botswana.
Oh, have you not? That's an amazing country.
I hear it's fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, but at the right time of year, if you go at the right time of year, then the Okavango itself is running very clear and very cold. And any crocs that are in the water, they're a bit sluggish. They're not their normal sort of hypercharged self. And so you can dive alongside them. And they're mostly feeding on fish. So as long as you take on that really confident posture in the water and you don't you get down from the surface as fast as you possibly can down to the bottom.
So you're not making those ripples.
And also creating a silhouette that they might target on the surface of the water. And yeah, it can be done. I mean, it's one of the riskiest encounters with an animal that I've ever done. But you know, we all got out with our fingers and toes intact.
Oh, mate, but you have been bitten. You've been bit by a caiman, weren't you?
I have. That though was completely my own fault. So we were working in.
Of course,
Argentina.
It was, Steve. Of course.
I know. I ignored all my own rules. We were on horseback. So we were on horseback. We were looking for a massive snake called an anaconda that lives in the water. We were looking for these massive snakes, and my one of the guys I was with, I think it was my director, said, Steve, I just saw some movement down at your horse's hooves. I'm pretty sure it was an anaconda. So I jumped down and I started feeling around in the mud with my feet for what I hoped would be a bloody great big snake. And instead I was walking all over the face of a crocodile, a caiman, like you say.
And they're big. I mean, caimans, some of them are thin. I've seen them in the Amazon. Some of them have got long fishy snouts, but the other ones, they're crocs.
Yeah, it was plenty big enough.
Was it?
And it swept round and took a chunk out of my leg. And we got it all on two different cameras.
Amazing.
And I mean, I could kind of remember going, oh my goodness, I've just been bitten by a crocodile. Did you get that?
Well, so there's no point in going through the pain unless there's some sort of gain, right?
No, exactly right. Yeah, so I mean, I've been working with animals a long, long time now, and that's probably the only bad bite I've had in all that time. And you know, I mean, we were back in searching for snakes the very next day, so it wasn't that bad.
You get dressed out on the ground, obviously. Do you have a medical person with you that can look after that kind of stuff?
We took ourselves to a local village, and they had a medical center, but they had a power cut, and there was no power, so they stitched me up underneath a tree in the front garden.
Yeah, mate, that's the only way to do it, isn't it? I think of myself as relatively well traveled, and you know what, I'm a complete amateur in comparison to you. Let's go back to when you first started traveling. You went to Indonesia. You can speak Indonesian, though there's many different dialogues in that archipelago, isn't there? Tell me about East Timor. I can only say that because I went there a long time ago, and I was there for the violence. It was when Ramos Horta was the prime minister.
Oh, yes. Yeah,
he got shot, didn't he, eventually? He got shot just after I left. What was it like? What was East Timor like?
I went there when I was, when would it have been? Would it have been about 96, I guess?
It's wild now. It was even wilder then.
Yeah, it was wild then. And I was young and dumb and kind of thought, well, I've got my journalist past, I'll be all right. And I went in there on my own, and it was awful. It was totally lawless. The Indonesian military were at the time there, and you know, for very good reason, hated by the East Timorese. And I was unfortunate enough to find myself swept up in a demonstration on the streets, which got put down by the Indonesian military, first with water cannons, and then with bullets. And I can remember just crouching down behind the bar in the hotel while the front of the hotel was shot out.
That's on the harbour, isn't it? The one on the harbour, yeah? Is it on the harbour?
Was it on the harbour? I have to say, I can't exactly remember.
I like Indonesia, and I've got a lot of reasons for liking it, but they did shoot up East Timor before they left it, that's for sure.
They did some appalling things. You know, I like you, I have a lot of history with Indonesia, but their presence in East Timor and in West Papua is shameful, and we could talk about that for a very long time.
I mean, the mountaineering is exceptional. The amount of peaks that you've climbed, that many, and also I can't climb a mountain to save my life, but the fact is, if I did, I'd be following in the footsteps of somebody else. What you've specialized in, particularly recent times, that you may have always done, is going where no one else has gone before, in a world that is continuously being exposed to human footprints. when you plan to climb a mountain that's never been climbed before, how do you go about it?
That is a great question. And it varies depending on the terrain. So sometimes we've been lucky enough to have access to a helicopter or to a drone nowadays, and being able to fly parts of the route can be really, really useful. You can find out where the stumbling blocks are. You can get a sense of where a route might break, so to speak, and which parts of it may be impossible. Other times we have quite literally sat for days with binoculars just underneath, studying a rock face, looking at the way the rock forms, at the geology, and trying to figure out what might make a useful route. Sometimes the rock will give away part of its features from its color or from shading that shows that you might have big overhangs, big ceiling systems. But more than anything, it's been down to just surrounding myself with really, really good people. You know, when I've been doing first ascents, I've very rarely been the lead climber. On a couple of them I have, but, you know, mostly I've been working with someone who is just way, way beyond my ability and knowledge and experience of being able to use everything that they've learned, everything that they know, is kind of the crux of it, really. I have the great privilege of climbing with a guy called John Aaron, who is, I guess he's the antithesis of me, really. He is someone whose climbing ability is utterly spectacular. He could climb a vertical brick rock wall as if you or I were going up a ladder. But the humility of the man is such that you won't find him in any climbing magazines. You know, he could be on the front cover of every single climbing magazine around the world, but he just could not be less interested. And his ability to look at a rock face that no one's ever been on before and say, right, well, we'll go 15 meters up dead straight, then we'll pitch to the left, then we'll head up there, and to climb things that no other human being would put themselves on, including people like, you know, Alex Honnold, Leo Holding, has been my ticket to the top of the biggest climbs I've done.
How important is the team, Steve?
Team's everything, isn't it? I think that, you know, we can lose touch quite a lot in modern life with real team situations, the kind of things that you will have seen with people in the military and people in conflict zones, where your team is your lifeline as much as a diver's cylinder is their lifeline, where you put your life into somebody else's hands every single second of the day and expect them to do the same with you. And I'm very lucky that I've got to work with some people for a long time, people that you instinctively know have always got your back. And when you meet someone like that, you don't let them go. You know, you make sure that everything you plan, theirs is the first name on the team sheet. And those are the people that, you know, when I think team now, I think of them.
Talk to me about that time in the kayak, mate. How did that happen?
So, yeah, we were doing a project, a series of 10 expeditions, each of which was a first, each of which had some element of it that hadn't been done before. And one of them was to descend a whitewater river in Bhutan in the Himalayas, which was totally unpaddled to a certain extent. Much like with the rock faces we were talking about before, to a certain extent, we flew some portions of it with the drone. There were a couple of sections where we got up ahead and we looked down onto the river with binoculars, but you can only tell so much.
Also, just as a layman, you don't know what those drops are, or you can maybe estimate the drop, but you can't estimate what's underwater. A drone can't see through water.
No, that's absolutely true. I mean, we used those things plus a little bit of the kind of what we knew of the landscape and how much the river had to fall to make I guess to get some idea of whether it would be possible at all. But then the idea was that as we descended, you get out at every significant rapid and you'd do a recce, you'd have a good look around and you'd look for obvious obstacles in the water. So for example, you know, if you get a big rapid and there is a tree down through the middle of it, that's really dangerous. You know, the chances are you can get through the rapid, but you're going to get stuck at some point, and getting stuck in the middle of a river in a big rapid is not good. So you would try and carry around it. The one that was a problem was we got to the end of the day and, you know, I'm sure that you've been through this yourself as well. There are so many times when bad things happen at the end of the day, when everyone's tired, everyone's exhausted, everyone just wants to get to somewhere and set up the camp and get some food inside them. And we got to a rapid that was obviously serious, but we couldn't see down to the bottom of it and we couldn't recce it. And I think if we'd hit that rapid at 11 in the morning, everyone would just have gone, do you know what? This is too dangerous. Let's just carry the boats up and out and around it. And, you know, it'll be fine. But we had that end of day kind of, oh, let's just get this done. And we talked ourselves into running it blind, which was just, it was a dumb call. It was a really dumb call. And my paddle partner, Sal Montgomery, who is just the most nails human being you will ever see. I mean, she is shredded in a way that no human being should ever be. And she's an extraordinary paddler. But she went down first, managed to pick a line. And then I followed and I didn't do as well as she did. And I went down this small waterfall where the entire river volume was being channeled into one short section. And I got caught and I got sucked under. My boat got sucked under first. And then normally in that situation, after a minute or so of getting thrashed about, you come out of the boat and the rapid flushes you out. And I came out of the boat and I just got dragged straight to the bottom. And yeah, it was the big difference was time. So I have had close calls before, but they've all been quick. They've all been things that you only realize afterwards when you're sat back in the pub with your mates. Oh, actually, that was a bit spicy. But this time, like you said, I was in it for 5 minutes, and 5 minutes is enough time for you to figure out what's happening, for you to process it, and for you to realize this is all bad.
So you are upside down in a boat with basically a tap the size of a football pitch dropping on you, and you can't get out of it. It's like when you see a ball being hit, it's just being pushed under the water and it's trying to get up, but it just can't get up.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. You have a certain amount of flotation from your PFD, from your life jacket. And that was bringing me back up to the surface every, I don't know, maybe 20, 30 seconds, but the water is glacial meltwater. It's absolutely freezing and you're being washing machined, churned up and down. So you've got no air in your lungs. You come up, you grab a breath, you're back under. And the scary thing is, I think that, you know, when you're a physical person, you get used to relying on your own strength and ability to get yourself out of situations. And after probably, I would guess, 3 or 4 minutes, I had no strength. You know, I could not get myself back up to the surface. I very quickly realized that I was done. I was gone. And I wasn't getting out of it myself.
So did you come to terms at that moment, Steve, with the end of your life?
Yeah, I did. I think I've had to think about this quite a lot afterwards. And I think that moments like that seem to go on forever. And you know, the expression of your life flashing before your eyes. I believe that's a real thing. I believe that's something that, you know, both retrospectively, a moment takes on more importance than it had, so you stretch it in your mind. But also, I think that probably your brain is a remarkable tool, and it's probably running back through your life to try and find some kind of precedent, something that it can anchor onto that might be your solution, that might be your way out of that problem, which is why, you know, it does. You literally find yourself going back to your childhood and going back to, you know, the first time you ever got into a kayak. But more than anything, I had time to think of my little boy and my wife and think, I'm not going to get him to see him grow up. And I can remember it so with such clarity. And it was horrific. Just that absolute knowledge that I was going to drown and I was going to die there. And like I said, I could not affect that situation. There was nothing I could do about it. And if it wasn't for the fact that Sal managed to somehow, God knows how, get back up against the rapids, throw me in a line, and she had one throw. There is, you know, she had no margin for error. She couldn't have brought the bag back in, restacked it and thrown it again. I would have been drowned by then. And she hit me with the bag first time, dragged me out, dragged me down through the rapids. And it was, you know, I've got a good kicking, but I survived and I owe Sal my life. Absolutely. 100%. And that's a pretty powerful thing. You know, I don't waste any opportunity to get on the phone and to tell her that everything, you know, my twins, my future is all thanks to her. Well, it's not all thanks to her. I think Helen probably had a little bit.
But no, what you're saying is you wouldn't have been there. And those moments often hit you hardest. Though you had time during that moment, what was it like that night once you sat down and sort of started debriefing yourself for everything and you realized how close you'd come to not being there?
It was awful. It was awful. I mean, I you know, we've talked a fair bit about the fact that I am naturally a very enthusiastic, very positive person. I took myself back to my tent on my own. I downed the best part of a bottle of scotch. I just sat there and was kind of like, what am I doing? You know, why am I, who has so much to be grateful for, putting my life at risk over and over again? You know, I'm in my 40s. I have a wife and a kid. Why do I still think that I've got anything to prove? Why am I still putting myself into situations where I could die? What for? What's the point of it all? And it, you know, I did spiral quite a lot after that. And I think that I probably, you know, looking back on it now, I probably should have got some counseling, but I have some very good friends. So I sat down and had some quite long conversations with who really kind of helped me through it. And also, you know, I was bloody minded enough to get back in the kayak.
That's what I was going to ask you. How difficult was it to get back in the boat the next day?
It was awful. It was absolutely awful. But I knew that there was
you couldn't get a bus or a taxi back down. So I suppose there was any way. but ultimately, you know, that feeling. That I've been hit once by sharks, and I had to go back in the water the next day, and it was my silly fault, and it's another story. But getting back in the water the next day, and it's nothing compared to what you've been through. I wet myself getting back in the water.
Yeah. Yeah, I was the same. I didn't want to do it. Would have given anything to have just gone. Come on, guys, that's enough. Let's just call it there. But you've got a big team of people who've all travelled out to the Himalayas to do this expedition. It's the one chance any of them's going to have. And in the back of my mind, I also knew that if I didn't get back in the boat that next morning, then I never would have again. You know, I mean, that is not an exaggeration. I would never have paddled a kayak again. And it's been a big part of my life. I learned when I was in the Scouts at about 11 or 12 years old, and there's very rarely a day goes by that I don't get back in a boat. But I would have lost that part of my life completely if I hadn't faced it. But to a certain extent as well, I cheated myself out of the proper proper reckoning that I probably should have had. And, you know, maybe I'm almost talking about this as if it's a good thing, but maybe it's not. Maybe a much more kind of mature thing to have done would have been to have said, actually, no, do you know what? Now that is enough. And you don't have anything to prove anymore. So just knock it on the head.
You've said prove twice, and I don't think you have anything to prove. I think it's in your nature, isn't it? It's in your nature to want to push the envelope. It's in your nature to want to see more of the world. I think it's also in your nature to do what is the right thing, which is to try and inform as many of us as to what we're doing to the planet, and also how beautiful this beautiful planet is. Sorry, how beautiful this beautiful planet is. I'm getting all very beautiful.
It's a beautiful planet. There's no doubt it's beautiful.
I'd have to say it three times though, do I?
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
But look, think about Steve Irwin. And he only came to me, and I was reading through the notes and looking forward to talking to you. There's a real example of a man that was, as you have, become a sort of global phenomenon. You know, you're watched all around the world. You're absolutely adored by kids particularly, but also by adults. As you say, you have nothing to prove. He carried on, and sadly, he died.
Yeah. I think that there's no doubt that I am reaching a time in my life when I'm asking myself a lot of questions, and a lot of the kind of questions that you're kind of asking me right now, really. I think what do I want to be my epitaph? What do I want to be my maxim? Is it really someone who pushed the envelope over and over again? Or is it someone who actually, you know, helped someone somewhere to find a greater appreciation of the natural world? Or is it someone who, you know, brought to light certain areas of conservation in the mainstream media? And I think actually a more fitting, a more mature legacy would be the second part of that, wouldn't it? You know, I think that the first part is more the dream of a 20-year-old, and it's a much more selfish, much more self-focused kind of goal. And now I'm a dad. I'm very, very aware of what a privilege that is and how special that is.
The responsibility of looking after yourself is one thing. The responsibility of looking after another human being is a completely different ballgame.
It is. Yeah. I mean, that kind of, I couldn't say it better myself. That is absolutely the crux of it. And you know, perhaps now it's time to put away childish things and to start thinking about something more constructive to sort of to work to now, to being the big picture for the future.
Mm. I mean, let's tick a few things off though. You know, the Marathon de Sable. I mean, that's, what is it? 350.
It's a long way. It's a long
300,
way.
Is it 358? I've read it down. It's I'm going in the desert. You're running. Oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. Do a marathon. Don't do 243 k's, mate.
I mean, yeah.
Also, when you were training with, you went out to Negev Desert. I wandered around there once at night with Israeli special forces, looking for drug runners. I fell over a couple of times. I was wearing gloves, and literally, it's the rocks there, razor sharp, sliced through the glove. Lucky didn't. I mean, the glove worked. But you were one of the quickest. You got your red berry with the Israeli special forces. What's that about?
Yeah, I don't know. I
I don't know. I mean, I was bored that weekend. I could have done the Pennine Way, but I thought I'd go do the Negev instead.
I find that I used to be massively motivated by finding how far I could go, by finding out what my limits were, and by trying to beat them and better them. And now, do you know, I think I'm switched on by different things. I think that I can get the greatest joy from getting up and seeing the sunrise, and particularly here, you know, having the kind of smoke sitting over the water and the swans cruising through it, and it's the Thames, you know, I get a massive jolt of positivity and excitement from that, that maybe 15, 20 years ago, I would have got from pushing that extra last mile on a massive ultra marathon.
But also, Steve, if you hadn't been to the places that you've been to, if you hadn't seen the sunrise out of a cave where human beings were living thousands of years ago, if you hadn't nearly drowned, if you hadn't, I will get on to, you know, gone out and caught anacondas or being bitten by a caiman, and I'm only scratching the surface here. If you hadn't done all those things, waking up and seeing those swans gently moving through the mist on an early Thames morning wouldn't be the same, would they?
I don't know. I don't know. Honestly, I think that I've been asking myself a lot of questions over the last couple of years. And I think that probably lockdown would have been, if it wasn't for the fact that I had three kids under 2 years of age, would have been a time to sit down and think, right, okay, so something's got to change. Something's got to develop. I've got to move in a different way now that is for, you know, not just the next couple of years, but the next 20 years, 30 years of my career. What's that going to be? How am I going to change? And how am I going to adjust to what is, you know, definitely going to be a very different future? And I think that I would probably have sat down and done that and have a much more sensible answer for you if it wasn't for the fact that I've been mostly changing nappies and not sleeping very much.
Isn't it good fun? And also, I have to say, as a father of twins as well, you know, someone just told me, he's not that close to me, just said, oh, great news. Bob's just had triplets. I went, not great. It's fantastic news, mate. But if you think one's hard, two's twice as hard. Three's three times as hard. And then beyond that, you know, forget it.
I do not envy your pal. Triplets.
But also, do you know what? How have you been with the sleeping?
I think that I have been awful with it.
Has Helen slept wrong?
Helen is a machine.
Well, that's for sure. We do know that. A double gold medal. And probably the fittest woman in the sport for 5 years, 6 years, 7 years continuously. She is a phenomenon in herself, isn't she?
She is, but I would never have, I mean, I wouldn't have known for certain though that she would take to motherhood quite how she has, and that she would be able to, you know, go through a night where she is up. Like last night, she didn't sleep at all. There was one twin at least awake every single minute of the night. She breastfed them all the way through the night, and then at 7 o'clock this morning she put her boat on the river and went out and did 18 kilometers in the rowboat.
Are you kidding me?
That is hard, and that is a kind of level of toughness and commitment that I cannot begin to fathom. I must have had 4 hours sleep last night, and there is nothing could have made me get up this morning and go and, you know, go out and do a session on the river.
It's a recognised form of torture, not having just having children, but also sleep debt is a recognised. I mean, and there again, that's when you, as you know, as you said, when you got to that point in the river, you know, being that tired, being either sleep debt or being exhausted, that's when things go wrong. That's when mistakes happen. These podcasts have one thing that we ask everybody. We have barely bounced off the meniscus of the pond in terms of some of the toughest situations that you've been through, which have been exceptional, and you've overcome them all. But if you were to pick one, Steve, what do you think has been the toughest moment of your life so far, and how did you overcome it?
I think that it's the one that we talked about, but because pure and simple, I didn't overcome it, Sal did. I think I'll move on and give you another one, if that's okay. So this was another expedition that I was doing in Venezuela. We were attempting to make the first summit of a tepui, a flat sandstone-sided massif, which was kind of like a fortress. The whole mountain had never been climbed before, and it was 600 meters of vertical sandstone. It was really, really serious climbing. And we just bit off more than we could chew. We got, I would guess, 150 meters up the side of this thing, and chunks were falling off it. And it kind of looked like someone had just thrown Castrol GTX all over the side of the rock face. It was slick and black and nasty. And we had a storm come out of nowhere. We're on the equator, and it was like being in the North Sea. Our kit was just being tossed around all over the place. We had rain lashing down onto the rock face, very, very high winds. And so myself and my climbing partner decided that we were going to get down to our midpoint camp as fast as we could. And our midpoint camp was Portaledges. We were actually on like tea trays, kind of, you know, stuck into
anchored into the wall.
Yeah, exactly. And as I started descending, my boots hit a piece of rock that was the size of a fridge freezer, and it just wobbled once and then fell. And Aldo, my expedition partner, was directly below me. And I can remember, again, it's one of those things where your life flashes before your eyes. I can remember the millisecond of just that tiny creak as the rock moved in towards the rock face, and I could tell that it was going to go. And the processing of Aldo's below me, this is definitely going to kill him. I will have done this. This will be my fault. I am going to have to go back to his family and tell them what I've done. And I'm going to have this hanging over me for the whole of the rest of my life. My clumsiness, my heavy-footedness, my rushing when I should be checking myself and telling myself to slow down has killed my friend. And it was a horrific millisecond. Now, as it happened, the rock slid off and it fell. Aldo called rock, slammed himself in against the rock face. Remarkably, my cameraman had hung his camera up on the rock face, and it's got this amazing shot of Aldo just pressing his face against the rock, and you can see stuff falling down behind him. And it missed him and he survived. But the utter horror of somebody else's life being at risk because of me was so much worse than any near-death experience I've had to myself. It's the feeling of just absolute. I mean, I'm feeling physically sick telling this to you now. I can just recall how utterly sickened I was by what nearly happened. And again, it's just one of those things where we just found out. I mean, typical expedition team, we all sat around that evening and we just made a joke out of it, and we just laughed about it nonstop for hours and hours afterwards. But it was not funny. There was nothing funny about it. And that is one of the few expeditions that we have actually called and all just sat around and gone, no, if we carry on with this, someone is definitely going to die. It's only an expedition. It's not worth it. And called it and turned back. And I am so, so glad that we did.
Thank you for that, Steve. You naturally trim, you trauma risk management. And that's what we do with the team that I work with, you know, particularly whether it's an interview with someone who's been, you know, been traumatized because the family members have been tortured or killed, or whether it's actually a road traffic collision, whatever it may be, you sit and you talk and you listen to everybody's story. And from that, you know, the massive guilt that you may have been feeling is put into perspective that you didn't actually make that piece of rock fall away. It was a soft piece of sandstone that was going to fall away at some point, right? Is that how you worked it out?
I mean, I still feel now like it was totally my fault.
And is Aldo, does your partner feel that way? Was it Aldo, did you say?
Do you know, we haven't talked about it for quite a while, actually. He'd be a really good person for you to have on this, actually. He'd probably tell you some stories about me. Actually, no, don't have him on, whatever you do. I think, I mean, you know, he has a military background, and I think he would be the first to say that actually there's not enough of exactly what you're talking about. There is far, far, far too much of looking back at situations and making light of them and making a joke of them and trying to get around it like that, rather than actually doing the proper processing that we really all should do.
Tell me about the polar bear.
Which one?
The one with the scar across his nose that's called Robert.
Ah,
No, I don't know. He's called Robert. But it was close. Like, I went out to Alaska a long, long time ago before I started doing what I do properly now. And there was a grizzly around me and he left his paw print. And then the wolves turned. I mean, I'm really naive and didn't know anything about really where I was. But the bear was big. And I remember them giving the advice was, if you're confronted by the bear, do not run. A bear can outrun the fastest man in the country. Unless the bear's hungry, you'll be fine. So what do I say? Have you been to McDonald's today? I mean, what, you have a conversation. So tell me, polar bears are considerably bigger than grizzlies, and grizzlies are big, right? How big's a polar bear?
So the very biggest polar bears and the very biggest grizzly bears are around about the same. And you could get males that could be standing 12 feet tall and weighing 3/4 of a ton. It's the biggest land carnivore on the planet.
And they move quick.
And they move quick. They move very quick.
Quicker than humans, basically.
Oh, quicker than Usain Bolt, for absolute, definitely true. So the way that I've had it explained to me is that in the Northern Hemisphere, you've got three species of bear. You've got the black bear, the brown bear, and the polar bear. The black bear, almost all of its diet is vegetation, mostly berries and roots and things like that. And they are very, very rarely of any danger to human beings. The grizzly bear, most of its diet is vegetation, but they eat a lot of salmon. They occasionally kill deer and another mammal prey. And they can be quite dangerous. The polar bear has a 100% warm-blooded mammal prey. They feed on seals. They feed on sometimes whales. And they will, in almost every single situation, at least assess a human being to find out if it could be potential food. So they had to be taken very, very seriously. And whenever you're in potential polar bear territory, you have to be very, very prepared for them. And you have to act at every second as if there is a bear around. You carry bear flares, you carry bear spray, which is a really potent pepper spray, and you carry a rifle. Well, I wasn't carrying a rifle because, you know, I've got an ex-Royal Marine sniper on my, you know, on my six. So he was the guy with the rifle. But I think the encounter that we had with a polar bear is one of the only things that I have had a negative reaction from the public in my whole career. And I can kind of understand that because, you know, this bear turned up on an Arctic beach. We were on foot. We had no way of getting out of there. And it came at us with intent, with every single classic sign of intent that you can have, including the critical one, which is in all of the guidebooks, which is you scare it away and it comes back. And in that situation, it is then classified as a predatory encounter. And we scared it away using our bear flares and using sound, using noise, and it turned and it came back. And so, you know, we stepped things up. We were making loads of noise. We fired a couple of bullets into the ground in front of it and did everything we could to get rid of it. And we managed to succeed in doing that. And the response on social media was very much of the element of, well, what are you doing? You went into its home and you scared it and you frightened it. That's completely unacceptable. Although I understand and I appreciate that people care for that animal's well-being, that's great, but it bears absolutely no relation to the reality of the situation that we were in. You have to do whatever you can to get rid of that bear, or it's going to be shot. And if it's not going to be shot by you, then it will be shot by the next human being party it encounters. So it is your responsibility to ensure that you frighten that bear away and you make sure that it doesn't come back. Otherwise, it is going to be killed. And people didn't really engage with that. And I can understand that. We live in such a safe environment where our relationship to wild animals is, you know, such an easy and placid one. We don't have any potentially dangerous wild animals here in this country. And so I think we've lost our understanding of the fact that very, very occasionally, and this has happened once in 20 years of working with them, you've got to play the bad guy.
I mean, there's a question about Helen. I mean, Helen, it's hard enough to be two well-known people, but two people have to train to that level and are also often apart, because I'm sure her training regime would have taken her away. Did that work? Did it complement each other? Or was it often, I'm back. Oh, no, darling, I'm going. I'm off to a mountain somewhere to do altitude training for 2 months because the Olympics are coming.
There's been, there's definitely been quite a lot of that. And I think that, there are elements of our life that are just really, really difficult and really, really hard. You know, Helen is a champion. She is a champion with a capital C. She is extraordinarily driven physically. I mean, even if people know that she's an Olympian, I don't think people would realize to quite what degree she excels. You know, following the London 2012 Olympics, there was an Olympians gold medal edition of Superstars. And she didn't just beat all the women, gold medal winning women. She beat all the men. She beat Mo Farah. She beat the Brownlee brothers. The only person she didn't beat was Anthony Joshua. You know, this woman is, she's insane. And I think that, you know, there are always going to be challenges. There are always going to be difficulties. But the opportunity to spend my life with someone who is so accomplished, who I admire so much, respect so much, the thought of all of the expeditions we can do together, the thought of the life that we can give to our youngsters is so exciting that it makes all of the other stuff, which, you know, it is a challenge, it kind of makes it almost irrelevant because the highs are so high that you can write off a lot of the lows, you know?
And is that the thing that you consider, or is that best ever man still inside doesn't even consider those bad moments? One thing I noticed, I mean, do you ever get the black dog? Does he ever arrive?
I think very rarely. I think I'm very lucky in, I can't think of any way of saying this without it sounding impossibly glib and fatuous, but I'm surrounded by a lot of people that have been through so much worse than I ever have. And every time I've tasted even a glimmer of negativity, something really, really awful has happened to someone I love. And it just makes you check yourself and think, you know, come on, you've got everything. And then added to that, like I said, I'm also very aware of what I need to make me feel good. And I know that I can always get a jolt out of training. I can always get a jolt out of standing on top of a mountaintop. I can always get a jolt out of going out and seeing a wild animal. And as long as I can make sure that I have little self-interventions when, you know, you're feeling low, you're feeling down, you force yourself to go out and do one of those things, it's going to reset a lot of those balances. I think that it makes it easier.
But if those depressing thoughts do arrive, that's exactly how you deal with it. That's what you do. What could you know? Do you know what sparks them if they happen? Because I was just reading something about, you know, you're talking about why you've been in lockdown. You're saying that it's brought you back to sort of like understanding your own childhood. And, you know, your mum and dad worked in the airline business. You were able to travel and all those things. But it's also giving you a sense of where you are in the world now.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that I'm in a rare position of waking up every single morning and pinching myself that I get to do what I do for a living. And so, you know, I'm so, so lucky. And I just want to do everything I can to make sure that I run that as long as I possibly can. And ever since I started in this job, I've kind of woken up saying to myself, tomorrow could be the last day. You know, all it takes is one single commissioner who doesn't like you. All it takes is one dumb thing that you say on Twitter. All it takes is, you know, one little change in life and this could all be gone. So make sure that you enjoy every single second of it and make sure you've always got a plan B. And that's been my maxim since I got started. And, you know, thankfully I haven't woken up yet to find that I've, you know, completely undermined myself.
Do you think that there, forget the social media thing for a bit, because that's just a minefield in every way, shape or form, I think personally. But in terms of, you know, do you think, we know the power of commissioning editors, I've been working in the game for a long time. That's a concern that you'll have over your head. But Do you think television and the thing that you actually do, which is basically traveling to uncharted parts of the world, do you think that that may be in danger now because of COVID? And do you think that commissioners may be rethinking the way that they want to make television?
It's 100% in danger. I think that, you know, we're all starting to question now whether it's acceptable for us to be thinking about going away on holiday to Spain for a fortnight. Well, think about the logistics and the challenges and the risks associated with taking a team of 15 people into the middle of West Africa, into a country where you have no idea what their COVID situation is. You might see their stats, but you can't believe them. They probably haven't got an ITU in the entire country. Your schedule for getting someone out if they get sick is what? Who knows? And then even if you can convince your team that it's an acceptable risk, you've got to convince the commissioners and the risk assessors and all those other people and the insurance company. And I can't see our job ever going back to the way it was. I think that, you know, it to some degree, I know that Bear and Guy Martin and a few others are already back filming in very, very, very specific parts of the world. But I think it's going to be a long time before I'm back doing the kind of expeditions that I've been doing for the last 10, 15 years. And that's another part of, you know, kind of thinking now, what is the future? How is the job going to have to change? How am I going to have to change for the next 20 or 30 years to make sure that I can, you know, still pay the mortgage and still keep doing this awesome job?
Steve, I can't thank you enough. You know, every one of your stories is incredible. You've lived an incredible life, and you're going to just do more things, more incredible things. I know that. I look forward to not seeing you diving with crocodiles or up some ridiculously high mountain or going down a ravine. I look forward to seeing you at Odd's Farm with the rest of the kids playing with the little tractors. Yeah.
I cannot think of anything I would rather do.
Thank you again, my friend. You've been absolutely brilliant.
Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Kempcast. If you haven't already, please subscribe, rate, and review. You can find me on Twitter at Ross Kemp and on Instagram at Ross Kemp TV. This has been a Freshwater and the Chancer Collective production. Thanks to the team and One Fine Play. And until the next episode, goodbye.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.